We talk a lot about the Supreme Court of the United States on this show, and appropriately so, because ever since the landmark case of Marbury versus Madison in 1803, the Supreme Court has declared itself to be the ultimate arbiter of what our Constitution means. But, you know, there's a danger with that. There's a danger in focusing so much on the Supreme Court that you forget that ultimately, the court reflects the values and the changing ideals of American society. Indeed, our guest today, David Cole, a Georgetown University Law Center professor, thinks that really most constitutional change doesn't come from the court, but from the bottom up. His book is called Engines of Liberty. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about Engines of Liberty.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
David Coles is a professor at the Georgetown University Law Center, and he takes a contrarian view, or at least I should say he takes a skeptical view of the most common way that we teach and learn about constitutional law. And that way is very focused upon the U.S. Supreme Court. In fact, go to any law school, pull out any constitutional law casebook. It's likely to begin with the landmark case of Marbury versus Madison, and it's likely to consist largely of U.S. Supreme Court cases. And that can create the impression that the court is the one and only institution that determines what the Constitution means. And that's not, strictly speaking, true. Or I should say, it's true, but it's more nuanced. Because you see, believe it or not, the justices of the Supreme Court are human beings. They do read newspapers. They do watch television. They do, even those oldsters. They even get online occasionally. And they are, to varying extents, plugged in to American society. And guess what? Over time, things change. Think about gun control. Think about Second Amendment rights, how those have developed over the past couple of decades. Think about abortion. Think about gay rights. Think about gay rights. Think about how things have changed with gay rights over the last 20 years. Not all of that was driven by the U.S. Supreme Court, but really a lot of things happened at the grassroots level, at the various states and various localities, and then only recently did the court follow American society rather than lead it. So that's David Cole's basic perspective, but I've already told too much of the story. Let's ask David to tell us the rest.
Well, I'm a professor at Georgetown Law School. I'm a constitutional lawyer. I've been practicing constitutional law for about 30 years. Started with a group called the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. Mm-hmm. And I'm a writer. I write for the New York Review of Books. I'm legal affairs correspondent for The Nation, and I write pretty regularly for other publications, including the New York Times and the New Yorker and the Washington Post.
And occasionally you write your own books.
That's right.
And that's why we're here today, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is my most recent book called Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law.
Wait a second. I thought that the Constitution was completely made, you know, on the bench at the Supreme Court.
Well, you're not alone in that view. you know, that's and the principal reason I wrote the book was I've been teaching that in some sense, and I think all of us have been teaching that in some sense in the law schools for years. When the media talks about constitutional law developing, they focus on the Supreme Court, on the decisions written by the court, on the dissents written by those who are unhappy with those decisions, and sometimes on the arguments made before the court. But my sense, you know, after 30 years of being a constitutional lawyer, is that that's really a very partial account of how constitutional law develops, and I think a misleading one. It's not that five justices on the Supreme Court impose their personal preferences on us through the lens of constitutional interpretation. If that were, in fact, how it happened, that would be troubling in a constitutional democracy to give unelected officials that kind of power. But you look behind virtually any significant change of in constitutional law, and what you see is that it wasn't so much that the court imposed it on the country as that the country, the people of the country, from the ground up, developed the principle. And the court simply recognized that that principle had developed. And so this book is really an account of three of the most significant constitutional changes in the last 30, 40 years. How did marriage equality go from unthinkable to inevitable over that course of time? How did the individual right to bear arms under the Second Amendment, dismissed as a fraud by Chief Justice Warren Burger, a Republican conservative justice, and as recently as 1991, how did that become a constitutional right in 2008 when the Supreme Court recognized it as such? And then finally, what explains the fact that President Bush, by the time he left office, had curtailed virtually all of his most extreme counterterrorism initiatives, despite the fact that over the course of our history, presidents have been given essentially a free hand to deal with the enemy in the way that they deem fit.
Now, is this a variety of that, the old phrase that you frequently will hear? Is it simply that the Supreme Court tends to be a lagging indicator, that it tends to follow rather than lead? Is that what you're talking about?
You know, in a way, that's right. Somebody once said that it follows the election returns. I don't think it quite follows the election returns, but I do think that it is more likely to reflect changes that have happened outside the court than to impose changes on the world. So, I mean, just to take the first case, marriage equality. In 1972, a gay couple argued that they had a constitutional right to marry, and their case went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court dismissed it with a single sentence, saying it doesn't even raise a serious federal question. End of story. 2015, the Supreme Court takes up the same question, the same legal arguments, and rules that there is a constitutional right for gay couples to marry on the same terms as heterosexual couples. Now, the Supreme Court in 1972 is actually a more liberal court than the Supreme Court in 2015. This is one of the more conservative courts that we have today, or at least until Justice Scalia died. Mm-hmm. So you can't explain it by, you know, a different set of justices, more liberal than before. You can't explain it by the arguments before the court changed. They were the same arguments. What changed was the world changed, and in particular, American sort of mores and culture changed around the dignity and status of gays and lesbians and of gay and lesbian families. So I tell the story of how that change happened.
Yeah, that's what I want to hear, because, I mean, obviously the judges and the justices ultimately still get to vote, and still it might come down to a 5-4 decision. So what are you saying is that the influences of society are making their way into the consciousness of the judges and then ultimately changing their votes?
Well, into the consciousness of the people at large, and then the judges make their interpretations in light of those evolving understandings. So,
Is it really an explicit thing in that regard? I mean, do they literally go out and take the pulse and say, you know, gosh, public opinion's changing, or is it more subconscious?
It's much more of the latter. It's much more subconscious. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, in the marriage equality decision in 2015, Justice Kennedy, who wrote the decision, did point to our evolving understandings of the dignity and status of gays and lesbians. So, but that didn't just evolve on its own. The story I tell is of the organizations of committed citizens who had a particular vision. And worked over decades in incremental ways, mostly outside of federal courts. In fact, they did everything they could to stay out of federal court because they knew they would lose in federal court, given the 1972 decision, mostly outside of federal courts to change the way the Americans thought about gays and lesbians. So it included things like working for changes at the state level in family law that governs whether, for example, a lesbian couple can both adopt a child at the same time, their mutual child, or getting first first friendly businesses and then progressive municipalities and then ultimately states to extend domestic partnership benefits to same-sex couples who were partners through their employment-related benefits. And initially, those benefits were fairly limited, but over time, they expanded them, again, incrementally, so that in California, for example, they ultimately got to a point where their domestic partnership law provides the exact same benefits to domestic partners, people who register as domestic partners, as to married couples. They also pushed for anti-discrimination ordinances, hate crimes ordinances at the state level. And then only then, once they'd made that kind of progress in a state, did they go into court and say, we have a right to marry. And they relied on the state constitution, not the federal constitution, because they wanted to keep it in the state. They didn't want it to go to the Supreme Court where it wasn't ready to go to the court. And they picked their states wisely. They went to New England first and Vermont, where they obtained something called civil unions, close to marriage, not quite marriage, but everything but the name, through a state court constitutional litigation. They then took that same strategy and went to Massachusetts. And again, the same kind of incremental sort of building up the ground, then going into court. And there they won the first judicial decision in the United States recognizing a right of same-sex couples to marry, the Goodridge case in 2004. And then they took that victory and they repeated it in Connecticut and in Iowa and in California. And those victories sort of created a kind of momentum. But those victories also were not final. They had to be defended. Virtually every such decision was responded to by the opponents with a kind of a referendum ballot initiative to define marriage as a union between a man and a woman, which meant that the gay rights groups had to work in the field of public opinion, advertising, the public debate, to engage with the people about the status of gays and lesbians and the legitimacy of their love and commitment. I tell the story about how those battles changed so that they lost those battles almost uniformly until 2012, when they shifted their tactics in terms of the kinds of advertising, the kinds of appeals to the public that the gay rights groups employed.
Before we get to specific tactics, David, let me just ask this, and it almost sounds as if this was some sort of coordinated effort over the last 40 years. Was there some sort of central organizing group or group of leaders that was suggesting these strategies, or were these things that simply grew up organically?
So mostly the former, a little bit the latter. It's very hard to exert control over, U.S. political and legal developments, but mm-hmm. to the extent anyone has, the gay rights groups did. There's a handful of gay rights legal organizations.
What are the biggest ones for the uninitiated? What are the most influential gay rights
Lambda
groups?
Lambda Legal, which mm-hmm. Has offices in New York and L.A., is one of the principal ones. The ACLU, Lesbian and Gay Rights Project, GLAAD, which is an organization in Boston, Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, the National Center for Lesbian Rights in San Francisco, and then a really interesting one, Freedom to Marry, which was founded by Evan Wolfson, and I tell his story in the book.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're speaking with David D. Cole, who is the Honorable George J. Mitchell Professor in Law and Public Policy at the Georgetown University Law Center. David's telling us about his book, Engines of Liberty, which posits that not all constitutional change emanates from the Supreme Court. Some of it comes from the ground up. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more with David Cole, so stick around.
Thank you.
So once again, it's time for a constitutional quiz. And how the heck are you this morning, Doug?
I'm doing great, Stuart. How are you?
Good. Well, I'm glad you do, because you don't look too good today.
Well.
You look kind of sleepy there.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I've been busy.
Been busy?
Things are really going great at Montpelier.
Tell me a little bit about that. What's going on?
Well, we've got a lot going on. We're building some new studios.
That's right. I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, we've got a raging...
You know, Mark is here in this studio, and I don't really like him.
Oh,
so I'm looking
Mark.
Forward to the day when we don't actually have to work with him.
I look, Mark. I hope we can import him over maybe sometime.
Maybe we'll do that. Maybe That'd we'll hire him. Okay.
Yeah, we've got some raging residential programming going. We're about to launch a series of 3 new online courses.
Very nice.
That'll take us up to 9. I mean,
one of them is a law enforcement course, isn't it?
There is. It's a law enforcement course.
Who's working on that?
Yeah.
We've some really good looking fellow named me.
Yes, you did help us out with that, didn't you?
Helped you out my butt. Yeah.
Wait till you see this.
It was Jen and me and Mark who did that.
Mark, congratulations.
Trickett. Mark Trickett helped us with that.
Wait until you see. It's a beautiful course.
I'm looking forward to it.
Police officers who listen to this program should definitely plan to take the law enforcement course from Montpelier.
Oh, it's tremendous.
Yeah, it's not open to the public, but if you're a member of the law enforcement community, we've got something really special for you.
Okay, so you've got an excuse for looking all sleepy is what you're saying.
No, 2 kids.
Okay, 2 kids as well. All right. Well, now it's time to do a quiz. Do we have a contestant?
Oh, we do.
Well, who is this contestant?
Hi, it's Stephen from Chicago.
Stephen from Chicago. We're glad to have you with us, sir. Are you ready for a quiz?
I have never been more ready.
Steve is ready, Doug.
Yeah, you're talking to someone from Chicago. My knees already hurt.
They do, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
I hope he gets it right so we don't get any visitors.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, Stephen, you ready? I'm going to give you a question. I'm going to give you 4 choices.
Okay.
All right, here we go. Feel the burn, rich guys. Wesley Lloyd's 1933 amendment sought to cap the take-home pay of all Americans at $1 million, Dr. Evil.
Seriously?
It's true. Representative Wesley Lloyd's 1933 amendment sought to cap the take-home pay of all Americans at $1 million. Where would excess dollars go? Would they go to A, the
national... You mean under his amendment?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so under his proposed amendment to the Constitution... What would have happened to any money that you earn over $1 million?
Excess
okay.
dollars.
Okay.
Would it go to A, national debt? B, to establish a national college? C, fund public political campaigns? Or D, establish a national space program?
In 1933,
Wesley
This
Lord.
Is a very hard question, and I will sympathize with Steve here because I had never even heard of this proposed amendment.
It's true. Representative Wesley.
Well, and I'm scarcely a constitutional scholar, but I haven't either. I think we can knock out a couple of these.
Okay, let's go through them.
It's got to be out of the question. So the first one was national debt.
National debt is A? Yes.
And I don't think there was significant national debt at the time, so I'm going to knock that one out.
Okay.
We're going to take the space program off the table. So we're then to political campaigns or a national college. I'm going to go with the college.
A national college. That one you're going to do. So that was choice C?
That was choice C.
Doug?
Well, that's a great choice, but it is wrong. In fact, it is A, national debt.
No way!
It's true.
So we did have a national debt back
then.
Wesley
Lloyd of Washington State wanted Congress to outlaw millionaires using a constitutional amendment.
Outlaw millionaires.
Feel the burn.
Steve, we're sorry that you didn't get it. But you know what? Sometimes Doug comes up with questions that are so obscure that I veto his question and I simply give the t-shirt anyway. So you're going to get a t-shirt anyway just for putting up with that really ridiculously difficult question.
You know what I like about this one, though?
What?
This comes out of a representative from Washington State where it's like, you know, Starbucks is located.
I guess
Microsoft is located.
Well, that was before Microsoft.
Amazon.
That's a long time ago. Steve, you need to, there's another reason I'm going to give you this t-shirt, though. That's because you are an old buddy of mine.
It's true. I try not to admit that to too many people.
Indeed, it's not. But years and years ago, my gosh, 30 years ago, you were the music director of the finest a cappella college singing group in the entire nation, and which is known as
the Princeton Nassoons.
The Princeton Nassoons, which just had its 75th anniversary, which you were able
which
to attend.
Which you missed.
Yes, which I missed, and I'm so terribly sorry. I was so dedicated to my duties here at Montpelier. But
Whoa. You sing?
I used to, many years ago.
Oh, Mark.
Well, sing is sort of in quotes.
We could do a little quartet here, couldn't we? Except there are only 2 of us. You want to do a verse of Old Nassau?
There's three, but I can't speak for whether he can sing.
I understood. Yeah, Doug. But you don't know the words to Old Nassau anyway.
That's
okay,
for your protection.
Give us a note, Steve.
We start with an F, but I don't have a pitch pipe handy.
Tune every heart and every voice.
Every heart and every voice.
Bid every care withdraw. Let all with one accord rejoice. In praise of Old Nassau. In
and we
praise.
Should probably stop here because we're gonna have to think about whether we sing the old words or the new words. People might
That's
get
right.
offended.
Well, that was nice, though. That was very nice. And I know that people all across this great land of ours are now saying, my gosh, I'm going to play that over and over again on my iPod because it was so well done.
You think we can get $1.29 for it?
We probably can. We'll put it up. We'll put it up separately, and we'll make tons of money, and I'll give you half. Steve, thanks very much for
now.
Your time. Send me an email, and I will send you a T-shirt, and I will send you a copy of the Constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
Guys, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be on.
A pleasure to have you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with author and professor David D. Cole about his new book, Engines of Liberty, in which he tells a lot of stories about how lots and lots of constitutional change emanates from the grassroots. In fact, he's going to tell us now about a fellow named Evan Wolfson and his organization, his grassroots organization called Freedom to Marry.
He's a guy who in 1983, he was a third-year law student at Harvard. Interested in gay rights, wanted to write a paper on the right to marry. And he went around to all the con law professors there to get them to supervise it, and every one of them turned him down.
Really?
They thought it was so fanciful, so, you know, completely off the wall that they weren't willing to supervise it. He finally found a trust and estates professor to agree to supervise this constitutional law paper. He writes a 141-page paper. He got a B+, which is probably the lowest grade you can get on a 141-page paper at Harvard Law School. But he then went on, and he didn't stop by, you know, writing that paper based on legal arguments. He went out. He worked for Lambda Legal. He was the head of their marriage equality project. He then left in 2002 and created Freedom to Marry, a freestanding organization dedicated to this proposition and this proposition alone, that gays and lesbians should have the same right to marry as heterosexuals do. And they became a major player. They were a $9 million organization in their last few annually in their last few years. And interestingly, they did not file a single case. The work they were doing was coordinating strategy, public relations, support to states that were engaged in ballot initiatives and the like, all the work outside the court that needed to be done, in Evan Wolfson's view, so that the arguments in court would ultimately stick.
Very interesting. Now, was that, before I interrupted you, you said, was that one of the tactics, or what were some of the specific tactics?
So these were all the tactics. I mean, these were all tactics, but I think one of the really interesting stories is about how, you know, in any campaign you have losses and you have wins. And part of your, you know, whether you succeed is how you respond to the losses. And so there was the gay marriage campaign had a huge loss in 2008 in Proposition 8, which was a ballot initiative in California. Basically, what happened in California was the California Supreme Court in a case ruled that their constitution guarantees marriage equality. The opponents of that, the traditional marriage proponents, put on the ballot Proposition 8, which would redefine as a constitutional matter marriage in California as a union between a man and a woman, thereby overturning the California Supreme Court decision, which was based on more general constitutional.
So the California Supreme Court found that the California state constitution provided for marriage equality. And
right.
then
and
the people of California decided that they were going to amend their constitution to say that it didn't.
Exactly. So that was a huge ballot initiative. The gay rights group spent $40 million, one of the most progressive states in the country. It was on the ballot the same time that President Barack Obama was elected, and nonetheless they lost.
Hmm.
And they were devastated, as you might imagine. They were devastated. But what they did was they didn't, you know, just sort of say, oh my God, it's hopeless. They got together and they pooled their resources and they hired some very sharp consultants, and they studied that loss. And why did they lose? How did they lose? And how should they change their tactics going forward? And one of the things they concluded was that the kind of appeals they were making to the people were not working in terms of persuading the persuadable to come to their side. So they would have the California ads, and you can actually see them on YouTube still, the California Prop 8 ads. I mean, one of them sort of analogizes this fight to the civil rights struggle against segregation and the struggle against Japanese internment. You know, it's about civil rights, it's about equality. Well, you know, from the standpoint of a gay rights group, you might think, yeah, that makes perfect sense. We are standing in the shadow of Thurgood Marshall and the ACLU and groups that fought against those kinds of discrimination. But what the consultants found was, what does that do to somebody who's sort of on the fence, who's uncomfortable with the notion of marriage equality? It says, you're a racist if you're opposed to us. You are like the people who supported putting the Japanese in internment camps or supported segregated schools. That's not likely to be a very, appealing view. Another ad had a kind of young, hip, cool guy who was speaking in favor of marriage equality, and then a kind of heavy-set, definitely uncool, schlumpy guy speaking against it. Well, again, it's the people, it's the persuadable people that you need to reach out to. And so what they concluded was that we shouldn't be talking about this as a rights issue. We shouldn't be talking about it as a cool issue. We should be talking about it as a way for people to express love and commitment. And we should be doing it with real people, not with actors. And we should be talking about the real way that people sort of progress in their attitudes on this subject. And so all of the ads in the 2012 campaigns involved heterosexual spokespersons, real people from the state in which the issue was at stake, so Maine, for example, Mainers. The older, the more Republican, the more religiously conservative, the better. And they would openly and genuinely just tell their story about how they, initially thought this was wrong and thought this was uncomfortable, but by God, you know, I've been married for 40 years to my lovely wife here, and I think that my granddaughter should have the same right to express her love and commitment for her partner, who is a girl, that I and my wife have enjoyed for the last 40 years. And in that particular ad, the speaker was a 80-plus-year-old World War II vet who'd been a fighter pilot. And he says, you know, people say I was brave for fighting in World War II. And he points to his granddaughter and says, she's the brave one. And it was just, it spoke to people. And it spoke to people who were in the middle and persuadable. And it was very powerful. And on four ballot initiatives where this was at issue, the votes shifted and marriage equality won.
Very, very compelling. Yeah, I've often heard it said that those sort of personal appeals, and especially the fact that many people have gay relatives and in many cases didn't realize they had gay relatives but until they came out, those sorts of things were ultimately what persuaded a lot of people when they realized it was about love and commitment and that there were people that they cared about who were unable to express those things.
Exactly. And even the coming out of, you know, that didn't just happen. That was
encouraged
through civil society organizations that fought for protections that made it possible for people to come out without losing their job or worse.
Right. There were lots of obstacles to that. Still are, but not nearly so many today as there were before. Wow, that does sound like a very effective campaign. I've often noted that in the last 40 years, it's just been a stunning turnabout in national attitudes with regard to gay marriage. And now you've really put a lot of flesh on those bones and explained how it happened. But that's not the only constitutional issue that's changed in the last few decades. Tell me a little bit about some of these other ones, maybe the Second Amendment one.
Yeah, so the Second Amendment one, you know, is also interesting. It's a similar story in some respects. You know, there too, the right went from one that had been rejected for a long time, over 100 years, the courts had said. The Second Amendment does not protect an individual right to bear arms. What it protects is the rights of states to have militias. The idea was we're creating this federal government, and it's a new thing, and we're worried about tyranny from the federal government, so we're going to protect the rights of states to have their own militias as a kind of check on federal tyranny. And it wasn't about individual, you know, gun ownership at all. That's that for 100 years, that was the view. And here, too, the way that changed was through a variety of political and legal tactics, mostly directed outside of federal courts, and only after significant progress had been made, again, mostly in the states, did the issue sort of jump the tracks, and could it prevail in the Supreme Court? And here the group, you know, there really was a lot of central organizing, because the principal group is the NRA, a very powerful group. That really was not engaged in fighting for an individual right to bear arms for most of its history. It was started after the Civil War by Union generals who were astonished at how bad marksmen their soldiers were. So it was a marksmanship organization, principally hunting, shooting, competitions, training, gun safety training, and the like. Didn't even have a political office until 1975. Created sort of in response to the first major federal piece of gun control legislation, the 1968 Gun Control Act. And only then does the NRA sort of decide to get political, and in 77 it makes sort of the protection of an individual right to bear arms and the advancement of that concept central to its charter, et cetera, and it really engages in earnest in this struggle. And what it does is, like the gay rights groups, go to the states. They couldn't go to the federal courts because they would lose in the federal courts, given the 100 years of judicial precedent. So they went to the states. They got states to amend their constitutions so that their state constitutions recognized an individual right to bear arms. And they passed gun rights laws in the states. And they, like the gay rights groups, they went to their most sympathetic states first. They were not New England. That was the gay rights group's sympathetic states. For the NRA, it was Florida. And I talk about a woman in Florida named Marion Hammer. She's in her 70s now. She's 4'11". She never went to law school, and she's widely viewed as the most powerful lobbyist in Florida. And she is also the first female president of the NRA. And that's where they start, so much so that Florida is sometimes referred to as the gunshine state. And they pass laws there like the right to carry a concealed weapon, stand your ground laws, immunities for gun manufacturers from lawsuits filed by people who've been injured by guns being used illegally by criminals and the like. And then they would take them to the next most sympathetic state, and they did that very systematically, so that by the time 2008, the Supreme Court's addressing whether it should recognize a federal constitutional right to bear arms, the vast majority of the states already recognized under their state laws a constitutional right to bear arms as a state constitutional law matter. So if most of the states already recognize the right to bear arms, an individual right to bear arms, it's not that big a deal for the federal constitution to so recognize.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with David D. Cole, who is the Honorable George J. Mitchell Professor in Law and Public Policy, there's a mouthful for you, at Georgetown University. David's written a number of books, and we're talking now about his most recent one. It's called Engines of Liberty, and he's telling us all about how much constitutional change comes after a great deal of grassroots activity. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and we'll finish our discussion with David Cole. Please, stick around.
And these children that you spit on and stay try to change their worlds are immune
limitations. They're quite aware of what they're going through. Changes.
Turn and face the strange.
Changes. Don't tell them to grow up out of it. Changes.
Turn and face the strange.
James Madison, brilliant political thinker, father of the Constitution, Dolly's devoted husband, and wine snob. Wait, what? That's right. Among the references to wine at Madison's table are numerous comments on the fine quality of wine served and multiple references to Madison's knowledge of the beverage. Hamilton once even tried to quibble with Madison over a specific bottle of wine, which Madison claimed to have recognized having known its flavor and having had some of the same importation from Norfolk. According to the account, Hamilton thought Madison was mistaken, as Hamilton had bought it in Baltimore. Mr. Madison took another glass and said, "No, I'm not mistaken. This is of the same importation as mine." Mr. Hamilton just smiled and gave up the point. But afterwards, as a matter of curiosity, he wrote to his merchant in Baltimore and found that he had purchased in Norfolk, and Mr. Madison was right. With the Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
A Supreme Court ruling announced minutes ago extends same-sex marriage in America. The justices ruled 5-4 that states do not have the right to outlaw same-sex unions. The High Court also ruled that all 50 states must recognize same-sex marriages performed in other states.
This is a historic day.
Today, the Supreme Court refused to take up a legal challenge to a city ordinance passed in 2013 by Highland Park, Illinois, that is a strict assault weapons ban. This is a bit of a boost to advocates of gun control, because if the Supreme Court had agreed...
The Supreme Court handed down a major victory for Obamacare today. President Obama took a victory lap.
Today, after more than 50 votes in Congress to repeal or weaken this law. After a presidential election based in part on preserving or repealing this law. After multiple challenges to this law before the Supreme Court, the Affordable Care Act is here to stay.
The High Court has handed down opinions on handgun laws and the right to bear arms, juvenile sentencing and life without parole, and the freedom of speech versus freedom of religion, plus immigration, animal cruelty, and the restriction on corporate
speech.
Several
landmark rulings on everything from affirmative action and presidential power to cell phone privacy. It was a term marked by both bitter dissents and some surprising consensus.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with David D. Cole, the author of a book called Engines of Liberty, in which he tells us all about how constitutional change often comes through grassroots activities. In fact, for example, take the Second Amendment. The 2008 Heller decision was important. It established an individual right to keep and bear arms under the Second Amendment. But it didn't occur in a vacuum. It turns out that lots of people were working for lots of years, paving the way for Heller.
They also supported scholars in sort of writing and conducting research and writing articles supporting an individual rights view, so that by the time, again, 2008, this gets to the Supreme Court, the majority of law review articles addressed this topic were advancing the individual rights view. When before 1975, that was not the case. They got the executive branch to adopt an individual rights view when John Ashcroft became Attorney General. He was a longtime NRA member. They got Congress to endorse that view in a couple pieces of legislation in the early 2000s. So that by the time this got to the Supreme Court, all the states were on board with virtually all the states were on board with an individual right to bear arms. The legal academic community was supporting that view. The executive was supporting that view, and Congress was supporting that view. And then, and only then, did the Supreme Court recognize an individual right to bear arms.
This is almost a divide and conquer strategy. It's like you know that your dad is not going to let you borrow the car on Saturday night. So first of all, you get your sister to support you in this, and then maybe your brother, and then you go and work on your mom. And by the time you actually say, "Hey, Dad, can I have the car keys?" They've already been whispering in his ear, and they're saying, "Oh, come on, honey, do it." And at that point, he finds it irresistible, and he has to go along with you, and you get to take the car out on the date.
Right.
That's the strategy they used.
That's right, it's politics, right? It's not. There's nothing untoward about it. I don't think. I think. You know, and this is my sort of two really normative takeaways from this. One is don't underestimate the power of a small group of citizens committed to a particular constitutional vision to change our nation's most fundamental law. And so if you care about a constitutional right, get engaged, work with, you know, the organizations that are fighting for your rights. That's the way constitutional law develops, and that's the way constitutional law is protected. But the other point, I think, is, you know, why do we agree to be bound by a constitution in the first place? We are bound by a constitution in the sense that even if the majority of American people want to do something like pass a law, if it's unconstitutional, it will be invalidated.
Mm-hmm.
That's a, in a democracy, an odd thing. And if the normative premise for that is that a bunch of white property owners back 240 some years ago agreed that this would be a good idea, what possible, you know, justification is that for limiting our ability to do what a majority thinks is right at any particular time? I mean, those people, they didn't represent a majority at the time that they signed off on this agreement, and they're long dead, and they're from a whole entirely different era. Why should we care? But we do care, and I think the reason we care, and I think the reason the Constitution plays an important role in our democracy is that it has evolved over time. It is not the Constitution that they agreed on. It is our Constitution. So today it recognizes that segregation is wrong. It recognizes that sex discrimination is wrong, things that were not recognized at the time, even at the time that the 14th Amendment was adopted after the Civil War. It recognizes that freedom of speech is critically important and that you cannot be punished for criticizing the government, which was not the case when the Constitution was initially written. And so how did that happen? How did that... It is critical to the legitimacy of constitutional law that it reflect our fundamental principles, not their fundamental principles.
So this
is about the democratic roots of constitutional law. The way it develops, I argue, is through the people engaged in a kind of constitutional politics, not ordinary day-to-day politics. It's incremental, it's slow, it's long-term, and it deals with the most fundamental issues of our time, but it is driven by us, and that's why the Constitution is a legitimate force in our country.
Well, I would even beyond that. I would say it has to ultimately rest with us, because I mean, you can go all the way back to Rousseau. You can go to that the Declaration of Independence. You know, the legitimacy of government is based upon the consent of the governed. I say that's not just legitimacy. I'd say it's efficacy. I mean, if you have a situation where the majority of the people disagree strongly over a period of time for long enough with something the government's going to do, well, the government's just not going to last. And James Madison, who was originally reluctant to write down individual rights and even referred to them as parchment barriers, ultimately was brought around for a variety of reasons, as you know. But among them was his idea that, you know, ultimately they can serve as an educational starting point. And it's something that, you know, ultimately people have to support the idea of individual rights, which, as you point out, is a difficult thing. If the majority want to do something and all of a sudden one person can raise his hand and say, stop, you're trampling my rights, that's an uncomfortable thing in a democratic system. But generally, you can expect people to support those things only if they understand them. And they'll only be willing to listen to the Supreme Court or other federal courts or state courts in those uncomfortable things they disagree with, and only be willing to follow judicial opinions if ultimately they support individual rights and if they support the idea of judicial review. And when courts get out too far ahead of society, for as they arguably did with abortion, that's when the problems occur.
Yeah, no, I quote in the book Learned Hand, one of the greatest judges never to sit on the Supreme Court, and he said in a speech in 1944 that liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. As long as it lies there, it needs no court, no constitution, no law to save it. If it fails to lie there in the hearts of men and women, no court, no constitution, no law can save it. And I think that's a really important insight. It's an, like many great quotes, it's an overstatement. Courts are important, the Constitution is important, law is important. But I think he's right in identifying that the ultimate source of liberty is us, and that it ultimately depends upon us. And what this book is about the mechanisms by which we, the people, in fact, enforce constitutional law. And it's through organizations like the ACLU or the NRA or Lambda Legal Defense Fund or the Center for Constitutional Rights, organizations of citizens who've come together around a particular commitment to constitutional rights and have committed to the resources and the expertise to work over the long haul to ensure that those rights are recognized.
Well, I think you've convinced me, David, but in case there are any doubters out there, you said you had a third example you wanted to share with us of how this has happened.
So the third example is a more complicated example, but it's it's really the post 9/11 executive power story. Before 9/11, in virtually every national security crisis, the president was given a free hand to do what he believed necessary to protect the security of the nation. And I think President Bush acted as if he had a free hand in that regard after 9/11, and he authorized torture of suspects. He authorized the extraordinary rendition, where we abducted people in foreign countries and delivered them to countries like Syria and Morocco so that their security services could torture them for us. He created secret prisons into which we disappeared suspects for years at a time, run by the CIA. He authorized the holding of enemy combatants without any hearings, without any trial, entirely in secret. He authorized warrantless wiretapping on American citizens without statutory or judicial authorization. But what's remarkable is that by the time President Bush left office, he had curtailed virtually all of these initiatives. So he had released over 500 people from Guantanamo. He had emptied out the CIA's secret prisons. He had ended or suspended the torture program and the extraordinary rendition program. And he'd put warrantless wiretapping under judicial supervision. So the question I address there is, what caused that to happen? And again, it's a story of advocacy by organizations, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the American Civil Liberties Union, Human Rights Watch, Human Rights First, a group called Reprieve, engaging in advocacy, much of it outside of the federal courts. In this instance, much of it outside the United States altogether, in foreign countries, to bring pressure to bear on President Bush to bring his actions in line with basic human rights and constitutional rights principles. And I interviewed a lot of people from the Bush administration who said that, ultimately that pressure, particularly from our allies, was a very important factor in Bush curtailing many of these measures by the time he left office.
Well, I think what you're talking about is the intersection between constitutional law and practical politics. I mean,
exactly. It's not politics of the sort of ordinary, day-to-day sort. It's really constitutional politics. It's politics about the most fundamental issues that define us as people and as a nation. And in order for these things to really take effect, it requires a sustained effort over time. It took the NRA 30 years to sort of move the ball on the right to bear arms. It took the gay rights groups 40 years to move the ball on marriage equality. The human rights and civil liberties organizations, a little shorter period of time, but as I tell the story, it didn't start with 2008. I mean, I think one of the most important initiatives in this regard with respect to constitutional rights and presidential power is civil society's response to the Japanese internment, which was upheld by the Supreme Court in World War II.
Right, Korematsu.
As perfectly constitutional. Mm-hmm. But the ACLU and the Japanese American groups didn't accept that decision as, well, that's the end of the story, we lost the case, we move on to the next one. They fought for 40 years to essentially reverse that judgment in the eyes of history. And they ultimately, and again, in very incremental ways, sort of poked away at it. But ultimately, Congress enacted a law that formally apologized for the internment and paid $20,000 in reparations to the survivors. And that transformed our understanding of that decision, so that Korematsu, the decision in which the court upholds unlimited presidential power in wartime, is, by the time you get to the war on terror, it is an anti-precedent. And then I tell the story, Fred Korematsu himself submitted an amicus brief to the Supreme Court in the first Guantanamo case, mm-hmm. saying, don't make the same mistake again. So it's that learning that is driven by civil society engagement that made it possible in this era for the court to reject assertions of unchecked executive power, and for political forces to compel President Bush to curtail many of his most problematic initiatives.
Well, David, you're getting dangerously close to inspiring me. Your book answers
really
the.
About, you know, we can make a difference, and,
right?
And if you get out there and fight, people have done it, and people have done it in our lifetime, and in really important ways.
Yep, and I think that's it. I mean, you don't want to be unrealistic. You're not going to be Pollyannish. It's not going to happen overnight. You're not going to win every battle. But over time, you can change society, and you can change it really fundamentally. And as you say, you can do it within your own lifetime. No guarantees, but
right.
you pick your battles, and you're intelligent about it, and you strategize, and you work with like-minded people. And that really goes to the heart of the American experiment, whether people can govern themselves, as Hamilton said in the very first Federalist. And that sort of activity, peaceful advocacy, persuading people, as you say, there's nothing nefarious about it. Whether
right.
you're more liberal and you like the gay rights stuff, or whether you're more conservative and you like the gun stuff, in each of those cases, these groups were very open about what they were doing, and they were working very hard for their positions. And to the extent they've succeeded because they persuaded their fellow Americans of these things. And that's almost the definition of a democratic system. Well, golly, what an inspiring book. I'm so glad you wrote it. What prompted you to write this book? I'm just curious. Was there a particular incident or just something else?
No, it really was the sense, that I'd been a constitutional lawyer for 30 years, and I'd been a constitutional law professor for 25 years, and I just felt like our sort of general run-of-the-mill discussion about constitutional law was missing out on a really important feature of how constitutional law works, and I wanted to make that case.
Well, David Cole, thank you very, very much for describing your book to us again. And what's the title again?
Engines of Liberty, The Power of Citizen Activists to Make Constitutional Law.
And that's available in your friendly neighborhood bookstore as well as online?
Absolutely.
Well, then I hope everybody goes out and buys 10 copies.
Me too. Thank you so much.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to David D. Cole, the Honorable George J. Mitchell Professor in Law and Public Policy at the Georgetown University Law Center, and the author of Engines of Liberty, which we've been discussing today. What a really, really good discussion that was. Thanks, David. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.